This is Glass City Humanist, a show about humanism, humanist values, by a humanist. Here is your host, Douglas Berger.
In this episode, we look at the just concluded U.S. Supreme Court term and how it shakes out for religious freedom. It isn't good.
Glass City Humanist is an outreach project of the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie, building community through compassion and reason for a better tomorrow. If you live in the greater Toledo, Ohio area and are looking for a humanist community, then please check us out. You can reach our group at humanistswle.org or from a link on our website, glasscityhumanist.show.
Well, I think you won't find anybody denying the fact that separation of church and state took a very serious hit this term at the United States Supreme Court. And one of the major hits that separation of church and state took, obviously, was the overturning of Roe v. Wade and Casey v. Planned Parenthood for abortion rights. And we'll probably talk about that in a future episode, because that's a whole other thing to talk about. And so I just want to let you know that Sholi, the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie, we issued a statement at the time that the decision that was released on June 24th was leaked in May. And we updated that with, now that it's an official ruling. So suffice it to say that as a group, we will not work with any other groups that do not support abortion rights completely. And so we also made some comments about the ruling itself. So if you want to check that out, it's on one of our blog pages at humanistwle.org. And again, we'll talk about that. I have an interview lined up with somebody that works at the Toledo Abortion Center. And we'll talk about, and they happen to be a member of the group. And so we'll have a chat about Roe v. Wade going forward and abortion rights in general. So we'll talk about that. What I wanted to discuss today is there were three cases decided this term from October of 2021 till now that focused on or turned on interpretations of the First Amendment and the separation of church and state. The first one, I think I might have talked about it before. It was the Boston flag case, Shurtleff v. Boston. And what that was is that Boston had three flagpoles in front of their municipal building in Boston. And the first two was the American flag and the city flag. And then the third flag was open to any group in the city that wanted to fly a flag. So obviously like Pride and POWMIA and things like that. And they would fly that. And there was just a basic form you had to fill out and they would fly it. Well, this gentleman who ran a Christian summer camp or day camp, I can't remember what, wanted to fly the Christian flag. And the Christian flag is white, and it has if you know the American flag, where the stars are, it was a blue with a cross, a Latin cross, Christian cross. And see if the official flag, unquote, of Christianity, all right? If you go to a lot of churches, a lot of Protestant churches, you'll see this flag flying sometimes, or they'll be on a stand inside. So he wanted to fly that flag, and the city said no, because if they flew that flag, people would think that the city of Boston was supporting Christianity, and they were afraid that it would violate the First Amendment. They refused to fly the flag. So the gentleman sued. And he sued, and in the initial courts ruled for the city. Well, it got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously So all nine of them agreed that the city of Boston violated the Constitution when it rejected the application to fly the Christian flag. One of the reasons why the court rejected the city of Boston in this case was because Justice Breyer is the one, I believe, that wrote the majority decision, and he went through this whole big, long checklist of, you know, is this government speech, and would people think it was government speech, and in the end, because it was a public forum, the city could not reject anybody. They had to, if you filled out the form and there was a general checklist of things you had to, I think you had to have you had to be a nonprofit or something like that. There was like a form you had to fill out, and that applied to everybody. So they could not reject an application based on the content or supposed content of the flag. And so what I wanted to talk, why I mentioned this case in particular to start off, is because for several years now, the conservative members of the court have been wanting to get rid of the Lemon Test. And the Lemon Test is used in church and state cases a lot of times to decide if a government action or policy violates the First Amendment. And so what the Lemon Test does is it just gives a small checklist of things to look at, and then that way you're able to make that decision. And the Lemon Test came from a court case in 1971 called Lemon versus Kurtzman. And what that decision was, the court ruled in an 8-0 decision that Pennsylvania's Non-Public Elementary and Secondary Education Act from 1968 was unconstitutional. And in an 8-1 decision that Rhode Island's 1969 Salary Supplement Act was unconstitutional, violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. The act allowed the superintendent of public schools to reimburse private schools, mostly Catholic, for the salaries of teachers who taught in these private elementary schools from public textbooks and with public instructional materials. And so Lemon was a major precedent in federal and local courts, and then it was overruled or overturned by a case that was decided, another case that was decided this term, and we'll get to that. It was the Kennedy v. Bremerton School District. And so the Lemon Test basically was considered three prongs, whether or not a government's action was deemed unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause. All right, so the First Amendment has two different clauses. It prevents the government from establishing a religion or prohibiting the practice of religion. So it's like two different sides of the coin. So the Lemon Test said that a statute must have a secular legislative purpose. And then the second prong was the principal or primary effect of the statute must neither advance nor inhibit religion. And then finally, the statute must not result in excessive government entanglement with religion. And this is one of the, and so if any of those prongs is violated, then the government's action is deemed unconstitutional. And so since 1971, or even more recently, starting in the 80s, when a lot of these cases came forward, is that government actions would be deemed unconstitutional, or if it seemed to be an excessive entanglement. And some of the examples that were used in this case in one of the concurrences was, Christmas decorations on a courthouse lawn. So the Lemon Test was one of the tools used by courts to evaluate these different cases about church and state. We see the first, well, it's not the first, but we kind of see in Justice Gorsuch's concurrence in the Boston case, he talks about the Lemon Test being unworkable and impractical, and that the Supreme Court and other courts have avoided it for decades, which isn't technically true. But basically, what would happen is that a government entity, when it was challenged for establishment purposes, normally would say, you know, we don't want to fight this, so they would change their behavior and be done with it because the establishment, you know, violating the establishment clause was very subjective. That's why they wanted to have this test, this Lemon Test, to help the courts. Now, I did want to mention about the Boston case is initially when I heard about it and it was argued this term, I kind of figured that Boston would be, the court would rule against Boston. Because what happens is if you create a public forum, if a government creates a public forum, like a courthouse lawn for Christmas decorations or the lobby of your state house for holiday messages or things like that, where you allow everybody to come in, you cannot censor any viewpoints. You cannot prevent any viewpoint from coming in that legally you could see in public, put it that way. I mean, there's caveats to the First Amendment, but if you have a flagpole and you're flying flags, you cannot say no to religious groups. You just can't. So I kind of figured Boston would lose this case. And the other thing to consider too in the Boston case, if you have a chance, and I got the links up in the show notes. You don't have to read the decision, but the SCOTUS blog that I read all the time, they have a good general overview of the case. If you want to take a look at that, you'll find out that the city had never denied a permit from a group to fly a flag until that gentleman's group was denied. So basically, the conservatives on the court saying that the city was being hostile to religion. So keep that point in mind because it's coming back.
Do you like what you hear? Would you like to support the show so we can make it better? You can write a review for podcast apps that allow reviews. You can share our website, glasscityhumanist.show, with your friends. And you can donate to the show using the donate link on the website. Any support is appreciated.
So the next case that was reviewed this term that weighed on church and state issues was Carson v. Macon, I think it's Macon. And what that was a challenge to the system that Maine uses to provide a free public education to school-aged children. In some of the state's rural in sparsely populated areas, school districts opt not to run their own secondary schools. Instead, they choose one of two options, sending students to other public or private schools that the district designates, or paying tuition at the public or private school that each student selects. But in the latter case, state law allows government funds to be used only at schools that are non-sectarian. That is, schools that do not provide religious instructions. So two Maine families went to court arguing that the exclusion of schools that provide religious instruction violates the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause. And on the day that this was decided, I think it was June 21st, the court agreed. Now, there had always been this idea, and this comes from anti-Catholic sentiment back in the early 20th centuries, that if tax money is given to religious schools, it couldn't go to Catholic schools. Well, courts had been throwing that out for a long time. So what they did was, in many of these people with these anti-Catholic sentiments decided to put into law these more generic prohibitions of direct tax money for religious schools. A lot of times they're called Blaine Amendments, if you've ever heard that term, Blaine Amendments. So there's been a history of government not directly funding religious schools. So how these religious conservatives get around that is you give the money to the parents. And if they happen to give it to a private school or religious private school, they can't do anything about it. And so that's why a lot of these voucher cases have happened. The secular purpose people have lost because the courts can't, they say they can't tell a parent where to spend that money. So basically, if a state offers money to parents to pay for schooling, then it has to be open to any school, religious or not. It has to be open to whatever school that the parents choose. And obviously, it's going to be not every school, because there is a caveat that, you know, it has to be an actual school. You know, you can't have scam artists and things like that, although you probably could. Most charter schools, a lot of charter schools are scams anyway, I believe. You know, as long as they're an official school registered with the state and they've been certified to teach students, then government can't tell you you can't spend your voucher money or your money that's given for education at those schools. So, you know, I can see where a court can't tell a parent where they can spend that money if it's provided by the state. But I also see the other side of the coin where that money is going to a private school with religious instruction, and you cannot divorce the fact that you're supporting that religion. You know, and so people are saying, well, they're giving money to this private school that happens to have religious instruction. Well, I don't see it that way. I see it as you're giving money to this private school that then supports that religion because it also pays for that religious instruction as part of the school day. When we had that local case here in the Toledo area with the sectarian school suing about being closed during the pandemic, one of the arguments that they used was that in the sectarian schools, these schools that teach kids and also has public instructions, they said you could not detach religion from the school, that it was intertwined in everything that they did. You know, so it's always, and that's what you see with a lot of these cases, is that the people that supporting religion with government tax dollars will twist and turn and pull stuff out of their butts to justify doing so. And they'll just cherry pick different things. And that's one of the things that they cherry pick. But to me, if I'm paying, if the taxpayers are paying X amount of dollars to Joe Schmo to send their kids to, St. John, you know, that money, that, several hundred dollars or whatever the vouchers are nowadays, is then paying that Jesuit to indirectly paying that Jesuit to hold a church service for these kids. And I personally disagree with that. You know, I think it should be separated. I think that if a parent wants to send their kids to a private school, then any money that they get from a state voucher scheme or other tax dollar scheme should be designated to pay for only the school instruction, the pay for science classes, pay for social studies, and it should not pay for religion classes at all. And you should be able to prove that.
For more information about the topics in this episode, including links used, please visit the episode page at glasscityhumanist.show.
And then finally, what I wanted to do was talk about the big case. This one was a major, basically blow up of previous church and state case law. You know, and we already saw this. The conservative majority had already blown away Roe v. Wade, and now they're blown away, in this case, the Lemon Test. And what they've been doing is they've been ignoring the Establishment Clause. And I'll get into that here in just a little bit, what I mean by that. But it was Kennedy v. Bremington School District. And this was ruled on the 27th, June 27th. They ruled in favor of a high school football coach who lost his job because of his post-game prayers at the 50-yard line. By a vote of 6-3, the justices ruled that Joseph Kennedy's conduct was protected by the First Amendment. Now, before we start talking about this, I want to explain that the petitioner in this case, Joseph Kennedy, the football coach, lied about the facts of the case. He lied about the facts of the case. The respondents explained that he lied about the case. The conservative majority ignored those facts. So I don't find that this decision is very legitimate. It's almost as illegitimate as Roe v. Wade, as overturning Roe v. Wade, but it is what it is. Okay. Well, first of all, the reason why he lied is because he was not fired. He quit. And he quit, and he probably would have been fired. But it wasn't because he was giving his prayers, it's because of the insubordination. The school district asked him not to pray at the 50-yard line. They offered to make accommodations so that he could pray, but they didn't want him making a spectacle of it at the end of the game. This court case just was talking about him having a private moment. So like people are thinking, well, it's the end of the game. People are scurrying around doing what they're doing. And he just took a knee and prayed. And that's not the case. That's not how it turned out. The general idea about church and state in a public school was that coaches and teachers and administrators are prohibited from leading prayers with students. Anytime that there's any religious activity in a public school, it has to be led by students. So, you know, students can pray anytime that they want as long as they're not being disruptive. They can bring Bibles to school. They can have a Jesus t-shirt, whatever. Teachers and administrators and faculty members, on the other hand, are limited in what they can do. And that's been like that for 50, 60 years since the Bible reading cases like Madeline Murray O'Hare's case in the 60s that prohibited Bible reading in schools. And that's one of the things. And one of the reasons why is because students are captive. They have to go to school. They can't leave. Most adults, when they're exposed to religion, they can leave. Okay? Students cannot. Also, the other reason is that teachers and faculty people and people that work for schools are there voluntarily. You know, they've accepted that job. If they can't, if they believe that their religion means more to them than protecting a student's religious beliefs, then they're free to leave. They're free to quit. And that's what Joseph Kennedy did. He quit. You know, he claimed he was going to get fired. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. The school board only recommended that his contract not be renewed, okay? So that was the first lie that he told. And then, of course, the second one was that it was just a quiet, personal prayer. And so the court decision basically said that people that want to have a personal private prayer, free to do so anywhere they want. I don't have a problem with that because that's true. You can. You know, if I'm walking down the street and I don't know, unicorn forbid that I want to pray, I can do it anytime. You know, as long as I'm not violating somebody else's rights to do so. Or as long as I'm not coercing somebody to do it with me. And that's what's different about a football coach. A football coach is the head of the football team. And usually if a coach tells a kid who wants to play football to do something, the kid will do it. If the coach is doing something, an activity, you know, the kids more than likely are going to want to do that activity too, because they are kissing the behind of the coach. They want playing time. And so, and I'm just flabbergasted that the U.S. Supreme Court, the majority on this case, don't understand the dynamics. And that's what it is. It's about a power dynamic. The coach gathers all the boys up, after a game, and he's like, bow your heads. And everybody bows their heads, whether they believe it or not. Now, I'm not saying that that's what happened in this case, because it didn't. Supposedly it didn't. But if you see a coach going to the 50-yard line and praying, and you're going to join in because you want to play football. And you don't want to make the coach mad. You know, that's why this case is different than most cases. Is because it's a coach. It's a teacher. It's somebody with, you know, it's the power dynamics of the teacher-student relationship. And they just totally ignored that. And in fact, it says, the court rejected the public school district's argument that allowing Kennedy's prayers to continue would have violated the Constitution's Establishment Clause, which bars the government from both establishing an official religion and preferring one religion over another. And it pushed back against the argument that students might have felt obligated to join Kennedy's prayers, stressing that learning how to tolerate speech or prayer of all kinds is part of learning how to live in a pluralistic society, a trait of character essential to a tolerant citizenry. Well, that may be true. Neil Gorsuch may believe that. But we know from practice that Christian nationalists don't want other religions. They don't want to see other religions. They don't tolerate other religions other than Christianity. So if you would have had a football coach that had an Islamic prayer rug and took it out there to the 50-yard line, which they wouldn't, but if they did, you would know that that coach probably would have been fired the next day. And there wouldn't have been anything he could have done about it. But what I wanted to make the point that I wanted to make, even though that this was a bad decision for secular people, the point that I wanted to make was this change about the Establishment Clause. In these recent rulings, they've been ignoring, like in the main case, they've been ignoring the Establishment Clause. In that, the change was, it used to be that, you know, with this Lemon Test, you could evaluate the appearance of an establishment of a religion or favoring one religion over another in a government action. Now, that with this conservative majority on the court, this six justices, that's not important anymore. They are more focused on the free exercise part of the First Amendment. So any government action that encroaches on free exercise, whatever that means, they're against it. And we saw that with the decisions during the pandemic when they sided with churches that wanted to hold services in person, and they said, you know, the health department closing churches was a violation because you're preventing people from practicing their religion, which you're not. You know, you don't need a building. Anyway, I'm going to get off on a tangent. I'm going to go off on those rulings from the past couple summers. But that's their thinking, okay? And that's different than previously the thing that they used to decide to allow religious ceremonies and things in government and recognition of in government of religion was ceremonial deism. And that was something that they made up out of whole cloth in the 80s, starting in the 80s, to justify religion and government. Because the Establishment Clause, you can't celebrate Christmas. The United States government cannot celebrate Christmas. I'm sorry. It is a religious holiday. Government should not be celebrating religious holidays for whatever reason. It doesn't matter. They shouldn't be celebrating any religious holiday. But because nobody complained about it in all the decades leading up to the 1940s when these church and state cases started coming up, started reaching the court, and nobody, quote, complained about it, unquote, it became part of the historical part of government. And so they had to come up with this concept that allowed for it without having to change things wholesale, okay? So they policed it, but the stuff that came before, they allowed it. And so ceremonial deism is kind of like the justification that a lot of people use for maintaining statues of Confederate generals in certain cities that we went through that whole big push to get these removed, is the historical aspect. This is about our history. Let's not focus on the fact that the Confederates were supporting slavery and that they lost the war. So why do we have a statue up to the people that lost the war? Anyway, that's how they use ceremonial deism. So it appears that they've moved away from that and simply just ignored the Establishment Clause. I shouldn't say ignored. Basically, they are not interpreting the Establishment Clause. And Justice Gorsuch, in his concurrence in the Boston case, and again here, talks about how the Lemon Test is done. The Lemon Test is gone now. And that they are just going to look at the history, the historical record, and what the founders believed at the time that they wrote the First Amendment, and that they are going to hold the Establishment Clause means the Establishment Clause. That means, did the government establish a religion? Did it promote one religion over another? Of course, they're never going to get that far because they'll pull something else out of their behind. Because when you start looking at, did it favor one religion over another, you're going to get into these weeds like in the voucher cases. Anyway, so they've totally chucked the Lemon Test, and now we're holding to what the founders believed in the historical record. And that's going to be a problem going forward. And that's going to be a problem for us in the secular community, because we can't change history. We can't go back in a time machine and change history. And so a lot of these arguments are going to be like, well, we've had this cross up, and we've seen it already with that cross case in Maryland. This cross has been up for 100 years. It's similar to the ceremonial deism in that they're saying it's been up for 100 years. We can't change it. So we're not going to change it. And it's lost its religious meaning, which it hasn't, because the religious people are still going to say that it's religious. So just to kind of sum things up, that the Lemon Test is gone now. They're pretty much going to ignore the interpretations of the Establishment Clause, the appearance of unconstitutionality. All right. So basically what's going to have to happen now, from now on probably, is somebody's actually going to have to be harmed by a state action in a basis of religion, kind of like what they've been doing with the voucher cases and that cake baking decision, is that if a government action forces you or compromises your religious beliefs, Christian religious beliefs, Well, you know they do that. I doubt that they're going to do any other ones, but if it imposes on your religious beliefs for any reason, you're going to win your case because it's you're answering the question about the Establishment Clause. Is it's favoring one religion or no religion over all others? It's being hostile to religion. You know, that's probably what you should do. Now, let me tell you, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not giving legal advice. I'm just saying I'm interpreting what I'm seeing. So the Lemon Test is gone. They're going to focus on this, kind of ignore the Establishment Clause and anything that imposes on the free exercise of religion, they're going to strike down or modify. Okay. And so that leaves a lot of us non-religious people out, you know, because a lot of these religious symbols and religious rituals that we are exposed to on a daily basis coming from our government have been there for many, many decades. And so we can't use the argument anymore that disfavors non-religion because that's not how they're going to interpret the First Amendment. They're not going to include the secular people. So what I would recommend that people do is get involved with some of these groups that take on these cases. The American Humanist Association has the They have a law department now that takes on these cases. FFRF, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, takes on separation cases. And American Atheists will do so. They'll write briefs in support or against something. Americans United, they take on cases. So, you know, if you believe that you've been imposed on by government action, you know, check out these groups and contact them with a violation, you know, if you believe that there's a violation. I know I've used the FFRF group before many years ago when there was a violation. I saw a violation here locally to me. There's a form you fill out. They contact you. They ask you the details. And that's the main thing. Make sure you have all the details. You know, it's not about how you feel about the case, okay, or the violation. You know, hey, this makes me feel bad. You know, you have to write down all of the details of the violation. Make sure you have that and let these groups know. And hopefully we can get back on track and try to protect the religious freedom of everybody in this country.
Thank you for listening. For information about the topics in this episode, please visit the episode page at glasscityhumanist.show. Glass City Humanist is an outreach of the Secular Humanists of Western Lake Erie and is supported in part by a grant by the American Humanist Association. The AHA can be reached at americanhumanist.org. Sholi can be reached at humanists.wle.org. Glass City Humanist is hosted, written, and produced by Douglas Berger, and he is solely responsible for the content. Our theme music is Glass City Jam, composed using the Amplify Studio. See you next time!